Welcome to Book Waves on Cover to Cover. I'm Richard Walensky. My guest is Nicole Krauss, whose latest novel is Great House, earlier novels, The History of Love, and Man Walks into Room. Great House has been nominated for a National Book Award and deals with themes of loss and memory and regret. In some respects, it did remind me of films like Babel, for example, and Traffic to a lesser degree, in which the themes are more important than whether the stories actually come together. So in essence, these are four interwoven stories with points where they connect, but those points aren't the important part of the story.
Well, I've heard the book described, to my great dismay, at times as linked short stories, and I definitely never thought of the book as that. To me, of overwhelming importance, a driving force in the writing, was the sense of the whole of this novel, almost this galaxy of moving parts where the echoes and symmetries and connections, yes, emotional, intellectual, thematic, between these stories holds the parts together. And so to me, although I began with these very remote points, these remote storylines and characters, and slowly began to draw them together, I was less interested in easy plot or narrative connection than I was, again, in the complete architecture, which is hopefully connecting them on a much deeper level.
The origins of the book began after you finished History of Love, and you were beginning to read up on Chile, and somehow that led you into the story of a desk that some of the characters at one point or another own. Can you go into that process a little, that the interest in Chile led to this fictional character named Daniel Varsky, who slowly faded into the background and became a very secondary or tertiary character who barely appears in the book,
but who cast a kind of darkness or light, depending on which story he falls into, on the rest of the stories, though not all. Yeah, after I published The History of Love, there was a period where I wasn't really writing, but I was reading a lot, as happens. And I found myself drawn, as in a way not strong enough a word. I mean, I became almost obsessed with reading about this period in Chilean history following Pinochet's coup, when so many were disappeared, often tortured and then killed. And I read everything on the subject and saw every documentary, and it became hard for me to sleep, really, at night. In retrospect, when I look back about why that was, I was pregnant with my first child, and I think there was something to do with the understanding that I was going to be bringing a child into the world, that from that moment on, all of my happiness would depend on his safety, his well-being. And somehow, by touching this very foreign history from this distant place at the end of the world, it was a way to almost reach around and touch this very difficult thing to approach. And it was a way to somehow deal with it. I did think for a while that perhaps that would become a whole novel. I wrote a portion that got thrown out that took place in Santiago during that time. It didn't leave me, though. So instead, I found myself writing a story. At the time, it became a short story. I actually published it. It's called From the Desk of Daniel Varsky. I thought that was the end of it, and it was simply about this American writer, Nadia, who is about 50, and she's remembering back to when she met this young Chilean poet in the early 70s, when they were both in their early 20s. And he goes back to Chile, and she takes all of his furniture, and of course, he disappears. And so for a quarter century, she writes at this enormous desk, which is one of the items she inherited from him.
It seemed that each of these sections, there's four sections in each part, it almost struck me as the structure of a play, in that we meet the characters, their stories are short stories, and then we have intermission, and then when we come back to them, we see the connection. In terms of your writing, is that kind of how your writing came together?
Not so much. For me, there's an early period in the writing. In fact, I say early, but it lasts for a good portion of the time that I'm working on the novel, a year and a half, where I am simply wandering, completely lost, with these characters, following each of their voices, trying to understand these different characters. And I'm aware of the fact that there must be a coherence between them all, because they all come from my mind, of course. And so I'm looking for two things. And the coherence, in a way, is secondary to begin with. The primary thing is, who are these people and what has made them the way they are. I was interested in Great House and writing very deep psychological portraits of getting inside of these people and becoming them. They're all first-person narratives. I think of them as monologues, but in a way even more so, as they're all confessions. The first one begins with, "Your Honor," is addressed to Your Honor, although you don't find out who that judge is for a long time. But this idea of these characters who all have something they need to confess and who you're going to go on a long emotional journey with was of great interest to me. Then later, the sense of, almost as in a musical score, what was the music that they would create all together.
And each of those voices has to be distinct. Were there other voices that began to intrude that didn't work?
Yeah, there were a couple. I mentioned one that took place in Chile, and that one just never became fully alive. I'm always looking for, it's very hard to say exactly what I'm looking for in a character, and when he or she has the mortal life blown into them and truly comes alive. But I guess I can, in a way, sum it up by saying there's this kind of marriage between a character who feels to me wholly invented, very unlike myself, maybe on the surface, and at the same time who feels deeply personal to me and into whom I can pour great droves of feeling and thought and experience. And when these two things come together, the imagination, the invention with the personal, there's a kind of authenticity. The character feels authentic to me, and I know that I found the one I'm looking for.
You mentioned the one in Chile. There was another one as well?
That was the main one. There were a couple of other storylines that really didn't go very far. That one went quite far before it finally fell out.
Were they also in Israel or the U.S.?
Yes, those places where Great House is set in, and also, frankly, the history of love. So we're talking about London, New York, Israel, and then Chile. Those are the first three, really the places of my life. I mean, places where I come from, where my family comes from. Chile began when the history of love is this just imaginary place. Again, I keep returning to this idea of at the end of the world. When you look at a map, it's this long, skinny place. It seems so invented in a way until you happen to go there, as I did after I wrote The History of Love, or read about it as I did, and it becomes very much real. We have these real places of my life that I'm always sewing together, and then this other place.
Your three novels all have this idea concerning identity and how the past affects the present in terms of legacy and the legacy that you're passing on to your children. How much of your own conscious life do you think seeps into the discoveries you made in terms of the characters in Great House?
I think that those subjects, how the past reflects in our lives and our presence, how it shapes us, is probably the theme of a great majority of novels, ultimately. I think it's hard to be a sensitive parent who doesn't think about those things. Certainly the idea of what I would be passing down to my children emotionally in terms of what we inherit from our own parents, moods, sadnesses, angles at which we kind of face the world, that became of kind of utmost importance in my mind, and I just was simply aware of it, almost aware of it without knowing what we can really do about it, because of course we pass these things down as we pass down who we are to them, naturally who we are. I was aware, having become a new parent, because of the moment in my life when I was writing Great House, of this question of what do we pass down? It's happened in a strange way to seep into my work. Of course, I was aware of it on every level when I first had a child and thought about it constantly, but I didn't think about turning it into a subject of my work until one day that story that I mentioned from the desk of Daniel Varsky was collected in this anthology, and they asked me to write about the inspiration for it. And at that time, the story was just beginning to open up into this novel, and I thought, why did I write this story? And I sort of went up to my desk and my study, which is on the top floor of my house, and thought about this. And it was only at that moment that it dawned on me that this desk that I write at, which I also inherited, though less romantically, not from a Chilean poet, but from the former owner of my house, I had been writing about this, my own desk, really, and a desk that I hate and I wish I could give up and get rid of, but I can't.
But it's stuck in your house.
Stuck in my house, and it's built into the wall, and you would have to chop it up to get it down. So as I wrote this little paragraph for the anthology, these two words sort of popped in my mind. I thought, why am I writing it this still? Why don't I just give this thing away? And I realized that I felt a kind of responsibility to it somehow. that it was a burden. And then that idea, that phrase, the burden of inheritance, kept just ringing around in my head and connected to this notion of my children. Because, of course, inheriting furniture is not a particularly interesting subject. It isn't to me, at least. But the idea of something much more abstract and emotional that we inherit and ourselves pass down certainly is.
As I was reading Great House, I was down in Southern California and spent time with my 20-year-old nephew. I can see the connection from my nephew to my sister to my father to my grandmother, who died 8 years before my nephew was born. And I think that kind of connection is what you're talking about here.
Yeah, certainly this idea of how things reverberate down through the generations. I can give you an example. There's another echo that runs through the novel, which is the echo of a broken window. And I had this idea very early on in the writing, although I held it back. I didn't use it. Okay, here's this window in 1944 in Budapest. On one side of it, inside a study, is a family. Their lives, they're about to be arrested by the Gestapo. Their lives are going to change forever. Somebody throws a stone through the glass. Where does the stone land? Because, of course, if their lives are going to change forever, in a way, it doesn't land in that life. It lands in another. And so I held on to that, and then that stone going through the glass echoed and fell in many different places in the book. It fell against the windshield of a father and son driving in a car. It fell through a retired Oxford professor's house. His wife's first book is called Broken Windows. And only until at the end of the book did I finally write the story with this riddle, where does the stone land? And I realized, of course, along the way, that what I was writing about is exactly what you're describing, this question of how does a historical moment or a moment in the life of a family or an individual, well, it isn't just that moment that it affects, of course. It can wreck a life or it can change a life mildly, but it often can reverberate down from person to person to person.
The effects of that creation reverberate with the kids coming back from London to live in their father's house, which he's created out of his memory, as well as with the attempt by Arthur in England to try to find out who the child was that his wife gave away.
In the Weiss family, which is the patriarch, is this Hungarian antiques dealer. It's he who was a child in that study when that stone went through the window. And of course, yes, he is somebody who wants somehow to save or protect his children from the kind of tragedy that he experienced. And yet, instead, in an effort not to pass down certain things, he does. He almost imprisons them. He makes life impossible for them because he wants to keep and preserve them.
The other connection there concerns the nature of memory. Man Walks Into a Room is about a man who loses his memory. The character of Lottie, the older British writer, tries to erase her memory and then loses it through Alzheimer's.
I'm often told that all three of my books have been about memory, and I suppose one could say that's true, but I would clarify it by saying that I think I write about the remembering mind, really, which is a different thing. It's an idea of how do we, again, this notion of coherence, how do we create a coherent sense of self out of our memories? So I began my first novel with Samson Green, this character who loses 24 years of his memory and only remembers his childhood and yet has to create a second life out of what's left, has to create a sense of self. And I think what interests me is not the loss, in a way. So again, my book's being about loss. I'm not sure that that's true. It's not the loss, per se, as our response, our reaction to it. How does one create a second life? How does one create a new self willfully, reimagine a new life after having survived loss? So Great House, this title, although it has many meanings, and there are many houses and many rooms in the novel, its most obvious connection is a story that you learned very late in the book, which is a story really about, it's a Jewish story, but I think quite a universal one, which is the question of, in the first century AD, when Jerusalem fell to the Romans and this place in which an entire people depended, what is a Jew without Jerusalem? And there's this Jewish sage whose response to that we can thank for the survival, really, of Judaism as we know it, was to radically reinvent what it means to be a Jew, to make it portable, something internal rather than something based on an external idea. So this to me is so beautiful, the way in which we can use our imaginations and willfully recreate ourselves.
You're listening to an interview with Nicole Krauss, whose latest novel is Great House. One of the most important elements of writing a novel is voice. And you've created a 50-year-old New York female writer, an Israeli father, the husband of this writer, who's also elderly, and a girl, a young lady, who mostly talks about her boyfriend and her boyfriend's family. Each of these different voices, when you're developing them, how conscious is that development, and how do you mold consciously that development?
When I was writing History of Love, I was very aware of and sensitive to the sound of each voice, almost the surface of the voice. So Leo Gursky has a quite stylized voice, as does Alma Singer, and the way their voices even look on the page is quite different. When I was writing Great House, I was aware of wanting almost to put style or surface to the side. First of all, I wanted characters who had the full range of their emotional lives, their intellectual lives, so I didn't want young children or even a man like Leo Gursky, who was very deep but also has certain limitations. I wanted people who could cross the range of all they were and all they wanted to be and their disappointment and, as you said, their regrets. But I wanted to get inside of them. I wanted to really plunge as far down as possible, so much so that you felt as a reader, and I felt as a writer, that I was completely within them. So, for example, there are no quotation marks. There's no dialogue in the obvious sense. You are really within these remembering minds. And I was aware of their differences, but their differences, of course, as people, more than the differences of how their voice on the surface would sound. But those deep differences, of course, kind of rose up and changed the surface of how I wrote them.
It appears that the New York writer is speaking to a person specifically. I think it's the Israeli father. It seems to be he's writing a letter, but it's a letter in his mind to his son. The other two are just kind of telling their story, and it could be written down or it could be in their head. So these are different ways of grappling with narrative.
Yes, I imagined each of them as addressing another, and that listener would be either a very solid thing, like in the case of the American writer Nadia, who, as we said, is addressing someone she calls Your Honor, or of course, Aaron, the Israeli father, addressing Dov, his son, who is out wandering in the woods as he sort of speaks this. But in the case of the others as well, I imagine them speaking to another. The idea of a confession, of exposing oneself, somehow the guilt involved, that the need to tell some very honest and difficult story, was of utmost importance to me when I was sort of imagining the voices.
The Catholic religion, not the Jewish religion, deals with confession, and yet at the same time, psychoanalysis, which started with a Jewish person in Freud, is all about confession as well.
Right. I wasn't interested in confession in the religious sense, of course, but if confession is the most sort of human need, particularly when we have sort of some sense of guilt, really. The idea came to me actually through the notion of the law. I had this original idea, actually, along with the original idea of writing about Chilea and Daniel Varsky, I had wanted to write about a judge. You mentioned films. In fact, the film that was foremost in my mind was Three Colors Red. I mean, the whole trilogy, but specifically that film by Krzysztof Kieślowski, which is one of my favorite films and has been for 15 years. And I had always wanted to write the novel of that film, actually, and I thought that I might. Now, in that film is a kind of fallen judge, a character who has retired as a judge and who has tapped his neighbor's phone lines and is listening to their conversations, and they're all embroiled in immoral things. And the idea of this person who had been in a position of judging others, a kind of righteous position, and who slips from that, was very moving to me. So the notion of confession came through first the idea of a kind of deposition, first a judge, then a deposition, and then slowly transformed this notion of confession.
What role do you think serendipity plays as it comes together?
So much. I definitely believe from the outset in pursuing every accident and following my intuition. If I had any sense in advance, let alone a well-thought-out, well-fleshed-out sense of where I was going, there would be no discovery. There would be none of that sense of arriving in a place that was unfamiliar or unknown, and that is everything to me as a writer. So from the beginning, I just allow myself this just chance, which, of course, the other side of that is potential failure, which I've had to learn to accustom myself to.
Outside of these dead ends that kind of work their way in the book, have you had failure?
I've always felt that the books have been very close to it. with The History of Love, I never knew how that book was going to work out. It was written in exactly the order you read it. And there was never any sure sense that these stories would come together. And that was even in a way more extreme with Great House. So I feel like it's something that I faced often along the way, the desire, the strong need and desire for these things to absolutely come together, but the continual doubt. And I would say that doubt, my own doubt, became a deep theme in the book. It became the character's doubt. It will also become the reader's sense of uncertainty.
Nicole Krauss, when you talk about your doubt becoming a role in a book, I mean, is it something that you see afterward, two pages later, you go, oh my God, I'm talking about my doubt?
You try not to psychoanalyze yourself while you're writing. In fact, you try not afterwards, but then you do interviews and it becomes inevitable. But I was aware at some point in the writing that my own doubts as a writer, my sense of whether I had the ability to write the book that I wanted so much to write and whether it would work out, were creeping into the characters. The book is filled with doubt. I mean, there's the moral doubt of this Israeli father who is questioning what kind of father he was. There is the self-doubt of Nadia, the writer, who has this question she can't suppress, which is, what if I was wrong my whole life to give up everything, sacrifice everything for my art? What if I wasn't chosen, as I thought I was, to be a writer? Or there's Arthur's doubt, who's married to Lottie and feels he was married to this mystery his whole life and wonders, is uncertain about how fully known we can ever be to one another. The character's doubts then seeped into this third level that I became aware of toward the end of the book, which is, if this book is a mystery to me, the author, as I'm writing it, inevitably it will be that to the reader. And what is it to ask the reader, not always, because I do believe, I do feel strongly in resolution on some level in the novel, but what is it to ask the reader to dwell in this uncertainty, to wonder what it is to make a life in uncertainty, which I think is really the only place we're given to make a life. We have to make these huge decisions about who we are and how we're going to live without ever knowing for sure.
As I'm listening to you talk, there's another level coming through, which is the analysis of the book. It's like, you know, taking this book, becoming the professor who read the book and didn't write the book, and then trying to analyze the book. That must feel very strange at your end to be trying to pull it apart like that.
It wasn't an effort to pull it apart. You become self-aware inevitably as you were writing. And as I said, from the beginning, in a way that's not of interest, you want full freedom and you don't often want to know why you're writing what you write. And for example, I don't think I would have written that short story From the Desk of Daniel Varsky if someone had said to me from the start, you know you're writing about your own desk, and in fact you know you're writing about becoming a parent and the idea of emotional inheritance. Well, the story would have been dead before it even began.
Obviously, you're very articulate about understanding them now, but when you're writing them, how do you kind of take them and put them in the desk and close the drawer?
It's not that deliberate. It takes time for a sense of awareness to rise up. And in fact, I don't think it would have in the case of that desk had I not pointedly been asked to write this little paragraph for the anthology. And one is not often asked, if ever, while you're writing a novel, what is this thing actually about? And of course, it's about so many things. And of course, you feel, as the writer, that there's no way to talk about this book except every word in it from beginning to end, and that every effort to describe it is, of course, in some way a lessening.
Since this book is a book of discovery by the writer, what was your greatest surprise?
There were so many on a narrative level. I remember the day when I put those two words, Your Honor, in front of Nadia's story. It was early on, as the story was becoming a novel, I returned to the story after about a year or more and opened it back up. And one day I just simply put those two words. I'd been thinking about that movie, Three Colors Red. I'd been thinking about Judges and Confessions. And I put the words there, and suddenly, I don't know, it was like the character bristled and stood up. The whole story, kind of a mortal breath was blown into it. And I knew, without knowing why or how, that those were absolutely the right words, and that changed everything. The guilt involved, the sense that she was trying to express herself with great difficulty to another, whoever he might be. And yet it took me 250 pages or so to discover who that judge was.
So you had no idea. Now, when you were telling the story of Aaron, the Israeli father. As you were writing it, were you going, who the hell is this guy and how does he connect up? Or how did that work?
No, in that case, I was still thinking about judges. And, you know, in the case of him, for a long time, I thought of having a father and a son who were both judges. Or I thought the father might have been the fallen judge. But then he became a lawyer simply, and it was his son who, in a way, surpasses him and becomes this very well-known judge. In London, he leaves Israel behind after some difficult experiences. Again, though, I wasn't sure what the connection would be between the stories at all. And there were other judges, there were other possible judges who fell out. So there was kind of great uncertainty in that narrative sense that really sort of surprised me.
Well, the character of Lottie, I thought of Iris Murdoch. I don't know if how conscious that was.
I was aware of that story. She's not a writer that I've read a lot of. Having gone to Oxford myself, I was very aware of John Bailey and of his story of caring for Iris Murdoch in those years when she had Alzheimer's.
She dives into a pond in Hampstead Heath, and I understand you actually have a friend in England who dives into a pond in Hampstead Heath in the middle of winter.
Yeah. First of all, I lived near Hampstead Heath for a number of years, and that landscape became very important to me. I used to walk there every day. And there are those bathing ponds there, and I always, you know, I never swam in them myself, but I always thought if I had been a different person, I might have. But I had this friend, a much older friend, who worked for many, many years as a producer on BBC Radio. He used to swim there. He does still swim there, actually, every day, and has been doing so for half a century, no matter the weather. I simply thought of him, and I thought of those bathing ponds, and I knew I wanted to write about them. I mean, this is another surprise, because I found myself simply writing, wanting to write about that place, and this idea of a woman who disappears into these ponds every day, these sort of very black, deep ponds. And I chose quite randomly to write it from her husband's perspective. And only later, after I pursued their story for a long time, did I realize, in fact, what I was writing about was a man who sees his wife as a kind of mystery, who felt that some part of her was always inaccessible to him, that he could never touch it, much as he thought he wanted to. And so those ponds were just simply a physical way to approach this abstract idea.
Was it the kind of thing where the once she jumped into the pond, that emerged in the same way that your honor emerged?
I knew that I was onto something that felt right to me, but it took me some time, quite some pages, but I did sense more quickly than I sense Your Honor that this was a situation. This was a husband who was telling you after his wife's death about this sense of inaccessibility and who discovers a secret about her that sheds light and also makes her even more of a mystery.
As the book progressed, Nicole Krauss, as you're getting toward the end, was there any kind of fear that your consciousness might work overtime to kind of push a plot onto one that didn't exist? Or was that never there at all?
No, that wasn't there simply because it was not particularly important to me to make these narrative connections. In fact, it was of great interest to me to, unlike in The History of Love, where I really was weaving three stories, braiding them quite clearly together, I was interested in the tension of holding these stories apart, holding them apart. So in the case of one, for example, on the jacket copy, we compromised after great difficulty in agreeing to describe this book as these different voices connected by this enormous desk, but in fact not all of them are, and that was of interest to me. I didn't want them all to have this easy connection of this desk. They're connected in other ways, and I felt that the reader who was meant for this book would understand that, would not want easy connections.
It seems that the existence of films like Babel give you a head start. They give you the freedom to do something that might have been a little bit hard for people to grasp prior to those films coming out.
Well, actually, that's true, but I think this is a very, very old idea. I mean, if you think, for example, of Baroque music, of Bach, you have two or three or sometimes even four distinct voices, and without dissolving them, they make a complete whole. So although maybe we've seen this in novels, of course, as well, and we've seen it now in films, people often say to me, does this have something to do with the time you're living in, that we live these fragmentary lives and we want a sense of community, we want to bring things together? I really don't think so. I think for me it has much more to do with a kind of structural blueprint of how my own mind works. My mind naturally takes pleasure in bringing these distinct parts together into a whole.
Nicole Krauss, you studied under Joseph Brodsky, and in fact, prior to 2002, you just wrote poetry. How do you think that impacts the writing of novels today for you?
I know that from the beginning, writing for me had to be emotional. I was never interested in just plot for plot's sake, although I suppose few writers are. But it had to be emotional. It had to have this kind of authenticity that I'm describing. That certainly led right into the kind of novels that I wanted to write. I suppose also a sense of language, naturally. I spoke recently to an Italian interviewer, and she said something so lovely, which I've sort of held on to. She said, you know, the real protagonist of this book, if there is one, is the prose. And I thought that was such a nice way of putting it, that how people say things, the words chosen, are of utmost importance to me.
In your book, as you know, Michael Cunningham's new novel, I interviewed him recently, writers who write poetry seem to take a certain kind of care with every word that kind of comes through on the printed page. It's like there's an understanding of the way words work together that a lot of novelists just wouldn't have.
I have such an affection for sentences, for the rhythm of sentences and for words and for finding phrases for things that surprise me or that I haven't been able to find a phrase for before. Of course, that's a deep pleasure in being a writer for me. So what other way is there to write, really?
Well, what about standard ideas in a novel, like pacing, things like that? Do you even consider those things, or do you kind of assume that it's going to happen unconsciously and let it go with what it is?
I am aware of the rhythm of the sentences, the paragraphs, as I'm writing. In terms of the pacing of the entire book, or rules about pacing, as you put it, I'm not really interested in any kind of rules. If there are any, I'm interested in breaking them. I think, you know, there's no good definition of what a novel is, and that murkiness or flexibility offers the novelist tremendous freedom. So every time I sit down to write a novel, I want to think, what is this form? What can it be here? So whatever the traditional idea is, out the window. But I was aware, as I was writing Great House, that though the narrative wasn't of main importance to me, of course it's important. We love to tell stories and we love to read stories. And what became interesting was how in layering these stories and having them work at these different levels, there becomes a real element of lots of people surprising me by saying, oh, this is a real page-turner, because I wanted to understand how these stories were going to come together.
A critic talked about delayed revelation. And as I was reading the book, the suspense is not necessarily in the stories, but, you know, how you're going to make those stories work either thematically or specifically in terms of, quote, plot.
Yeah, and I think that suspense was something, again, I only became aware of deeper into the writing.
Was there any way that you could augment it, or did you just kind of let it play itself out?
Again, one is aware of these things on many different levels, not always consciously, but I, for example, the question of that stone that goes through the window, I was aware in some sense that to hold that until the end was going to work much more powerfully. To give it too soon wouldn't have worked as well. So yes, there is a sense of at what moment to place each detail.
Then when you've got this big thing, we'll call it this manuscript, though of course it's in your computer, at that point, right, when you've come to the end, is the book done, or do you kind of have to look back at it and go, okay, I have the building blocks, but now I need to put the pictures on the wall, or are the pictures already there?
For the most part, the pictures are already there. Normally, when I get to the end of the book, I will go over it a few times after readers have read it, and I don't give it to readers until the end to get a sense of how it sounds to them, because, of course, something which is completely obvious to me, the writer may not be so to the reader. And so I have to make amendments and changes for that and pacing and things like that.
Right.
The best way I can describe it is that I do think of this novel, and in fact novels in general, and I always have, as houses. The title Great House was bound to become a title of a novel that I would write when I look back and think about it retrospectively. I make the doorknob before I make the door, then the door before the room, and then many, many rooms. And then there is a moment at some point when I step back toward the end of the room, and I say, oh, and that's what the house looks like. So that's what it looks like from the outside. And I have a sense of that, but I am building it very much from inside.
Well, I noticed in my notes here several architectural metaphors, and they came out without reference to Great House at all, without reference to the content of the book.
Yeah, I always try to explain that. I'm really not good at a lot of things, but one thing that I do have is a very, very strong spatial sense. And I think that has everything to do with how I put these fragments, these pieces, these different storylines together, it's like whenever I go to a foreign city, as I walk around and I don't know the city, I do begin to see it from aerially, from above, so that I'm putting the different pieces and streets together, and I have a very strong sense of how it all works together. So, and I think this, it's somehow the same. It's, you can call it rhythmic, you can think of it as a musical score, you can think of it architecturally. Maybe all of those things are exactly the same thing.
Books themselves are about exploring ideas. We started this interview by talking about the legacy that you were going to pass on to your children. So now you've written the book, you've gone on tour, you've talked about the book. What do you think writing the book has done in terms of changing you and your perception of legacy, if anything?
I'm not sure if I have a good answer to that. What I do know is that with each book, of course, one changes over the course of writing it. It changes one fundamentally in some deep way. You can't shine a light on some very difficult places in oneself and go to unknown places and make discoveries without being formed by them. At the start of this book, I was a new parent. Now I have two sons, 4.5 and 1.5. I'm in a different place, and I think different things about how we can or can't change what we pass down to them. But, yeah, the process is one I guess I'm continually drawn to.
Nicole Krauss, in going to IMDb, I noticed that History of Love was supposed to be a film directed by Alfonso Cuarón and released in 2011. Is it in limbo? What's going on?
Yes, I don't really know. I try to keep my head completely out of the film business and what might or might not become of the poor novel. The most I think is, well, what a strange and unexpected and to some degree wonderful thing that someone would want to make a film out of this book. Whether it will become that or not and what kind of film it would be, I don't know.
Do you have any idea? Is there a script? Is there anything?
There is a script.
Nicole Krauss, now Great House has been out. Are you starting that searching around for another book?
I find that because I try to put everything I can in the novels, I mean, because there are these rooms and houses, I'm constantly adding on and making more space for whatever it is that I'm thinking about or concerned at the time of writing. So when it's finally finished, there's a sense of being totally emptied out. And it takes time to really fill back up again, to find that thing of great concern, that itch that can't be scratched any other way except through writing a novel. I don't even know that I've had time to think about that, let alone actually start it.
In Great House, you have not only the story, The Desk of Daniel Varsky, but that odd shark story, which was supposed to be your story and turned into someone else's story. Are there pieces sitting back there that may wind up just a little stone on a beach?
Yeah, there are a number. You alluded to the story which becomes Dove's novel in the book, which is the story about this shark in this illuminated tank, which is hooked by tubes and wires to these sleeping dreamers, and all of their kind of sadness is channeled into this great beast. And that was a novel that I actually thought that I was going to write, but it kind of got submerged, became submerged, and it sunk to the bottom and just became this thing that flits across the surface. So there's that novel to write or not write one day. Probably it won't get written. But there isn't a story that I find myself returning to still, although the book is now finished. I had thought of writing the story of Dove, this judge who arrives at his father's house and announces that he has resigned rather unexpectedly. And again, I talked about this idea of the fallen judge. So I had thought that I would write that his voice would be a voice in the book. But for whatever reason, and I can't exactly say why, I didn't go there in this novel, and I still somehow am drawn to occupying that life. What would it mean to be him?
You've been listening to an interview with Nicole Krauss, whose latest novel is Great House. I'm Richard Walensky on Cover to Cover.